Welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine on this Thursday, February 4th, 2021. Sorry about having to do this to you, our loyal listeners, again, but we are rebroadcasting an edited version of an old show. It originally aired on January 17, 2008. UW-Madison anthropologist John Hawks talked about his research where human evolution may be happening at a faster rate. Here's the show.
From Darwin's theory of evolution to Watson's discovery of DNA, this is the Perpetual Notion Machine for Thursday, January 17th, 2008. I'm your host, Jim Carrier. Our guest tonight is John Hawks, professor of anthropology at UW-Madison. His research on the fast pace of human evolution has received national attention. This runs counter to conventional theory. Professor Hawks is here to explain his findings and how data from the Human Genome Project helped in that research. And as always, we have Science Roundup, a compilation of the week's science news with PNM reporter Mark Young. John Hawks received both his master's and PhD from the University of Michigan, studying the evolution of human population size. He's been an assistant professor at UW-Madison for the last 5 years. Other research interests include paleoanthropology, anthropological genomics, and population genetics. Now with our guest is PNM's Dennis Schaefer.
Thanks a lot, Jim. Welcome to the show, John. Glad to have you here.
Thanks.
We've talked a little bit before the show. I was having the most difficult time trying to come up with really superb questions. And the one question that I have, and I don't want you to necessarily answer this, but I'll probably, hopefully, we'll come up with an answer by the time our interview is over, is how do you know that the process of human evolution is speeding up?
Okay.
But let me ask you this first, and it might be just as vague, I don't know, but how can you measure evolution? Is it actually measurable?
Well, there's lots of different ways that we could talk about how fast things are happening. So in my study, I'm interested mainly in genetic changes. And for genetic changes, you know, a gene sequence is a list of chemicals, and different people have different chemicals at each of those places in the sequence. And so when we talk about how fast are things changing, it's a question of how fast are these differences arising in humans and how fast do they become common in a population. That's one way of talking about how fast things happen. Another way is to measure people, you know, look at them. How fast are their physical characteristics changing over time? And of course, we can study ancient skeletons to get some idea of what people were like in the past, and we can take averages over time to see how those have changed. So those are two different ways of talking about change.
Okay, now, if I, you know, read this correctly, you used an offshoot of the Human Genome Project, and is that the actual data that you used to be able to come up with your conclusions?
That's right. For our study, we're looking at a set of data called the HapMap. And this is an outshoot of the Human Genome Project. The Human Genome Project sequenced the DNA of one person. So you had a copy of the sequence from one individual. The next stage of this was to look at the variations that make different people different. And so the first stage of this HapMap has sequenced 3 million differences that occur between people in populations, and they've looked for those differences in about 100 people from Europe, about 100 from West Asia, and about 100 from East Asia, West Africa, I should say, and East Asia. So that is sort of the first step in understanding the depth of variation between people in the human genome.
So they took samples of DNA mm-hmm. from how many? You said maybe 100?
From about 100 people in Europe, Africa, and Asia.
Just those three locations? Why did they pick those three regions? Is it that the origin of humanity?
This is one of those things where it's bureaucratic necessity, right? It turns out that these Europeans are actually Mormons from Utah. And that's where the genome sequencing okay. project was going on. The Africans were chosen to bring diversity into this, and West Africa, because that's the origin of most of the African Americans. So they want to do health-related things. And East Asia they brought in because that's another source population for the American diversity, but also because they were involving genome sequencing centers in Japan and in China. So it's almost entirely bureaucratic as opposed to anything else. But secondarily, because we want to talk about health variation among the populations that make up the big populations of the U.S., Europe, and East Asia.
Okay. Now, what did you do with this information? Did you just, I mean, is there like certain gene sequences that you compared? And you compared them against each of those three populations?
That's right.
And then you tried to find differences between those three?
We were especially interested not in the differences between those populations, but instead in differences that occurred within each of those populations. So things that make Europeans different from other Europeans, things that make Africans different from other Africans. And we were interested in the small set of things that look like they were under recent rapid change. Now, we can look for recent rapid changes when we have a long sequence of DNA, because usually, if you compare a bunch of people for a long sequence of stuff, they're all going to be different in different places. They're going to sort of be scrambled so that things aren't consistently the same sequence in everybody. If you find that half of people have precisely the same sequence of things, that's strange and unusual, especially if the other half of people are scrambled. The only way that you get a long sequence that's the same in a lot of people is if that long sequence hasn't been around very long. It hasn't had time to get scrambled up. And so when we were looking for these long sequences of things that are the same in a lot of people, we're looking for things that are recent. But recent things that are very common, that occur in a large fraction of people, that's unusual. It's a sign that something started out very rare and rapidly became common. That kind of rapid shift from something being very rare to something now being common, and we were looking for things that were in at least 20% of people, that's caused by natural selection. That means that that gene, the gene at the center of this sequence, has some advantage that's caused it to rise in frequency from zero up to at least 20%.
Okay. I'm a little confused, but bear with me. How many genes are we talking about when you say in a sequence? And does that mean then that if your sequence is unchanged and it extends longer, then that's what's being kept from generation to generation?
That's right. In total, in humans, our genome has about 20,000 genes in it. We were able to identify about 3,000 of these that look like they've undergone really rapid shifts in the population. They've been changing rapidly within the last 10,000 years. That rapid change is indicative of something in our environment that's driving humans to be different from what they used to be. So we're looking at natural selection.
Okay. And you found that maybe 20% of the population has this condition?
For each of these 3,000 genes, there's a different number. For some of them, it's as low as 20%. For some of them, it's as high as 80%. And in fact, those cutoffs are just based on the sample that we had. We were only looking at a limited number of people. If we could look at more people, we would be able to look for things that were not yet as common as 20% or were more common than 80%.
Okay. Is it the same sequences, or is it a different sequence for different populations or different people?
It's different ones in different populations. These populations are getting different genes, accelerating in evolution really quickly.
Okay. Now, is it possible, can you specifically identify the genes that have changed?
Some of them, we know where all of them are. And I would say that in the human genome, you have to understand that we've got 20,000 genes, and geneticists know with really good detail what about 1,000 of them do. And they know with moderate detail sort of what another 8 or 9,000 of them do. And for half of them, really all that we know about them is that they're chemically similar to a gene in a mouse that does something, or they're chemically similar to other genes that are integrated into a cell membrane. You know, so our level of detail about what we know and understand really varies by genes. I can talk about things that we know really well what they do. So there's a gene called lactase. This gene makes us able to digest the lactose, the sugar in milk. Most adults in the world the normal adults in the world can't digest this sugar at all. It's something that you have when you're a kid, when you're drinking breast milk, and when you are off the breast, you don't need to digest milk anymore. So this gene just becomes deactivated. In some populations that have been keeping dairy animals for a long time, goats, cows, sheep, these people sometimes have a new mutation that lets them digest milk as adults. The advantage of that mutation is because you get energy from drinking milk in these populations. That's necessary to sustain your life, or if you're a woman, to sustain successful pregnancies, which is a huge energy burden. So it's useful to be able to do that. But it's only a minority of the world's population that have gotten this mutation. It's very common in Northern Europeans. In Northern Europe, this mutation is less than 8,000 years old. So this is one of the recent rapid changes. It's a new gene variant. It has a noticeable effect. It has an advantage in the context of a new diet, because before 10,000 years ago, nobody had any domesticated cattle.
Okay, let me go back a little bit. You talk about, you know, variation over time, but one thing that kind of bothers me a little bit is that the HapMap is basically a sample of today, say. Mm-hmm. How can you, you know, justify that the changes have occurred over time? I mean, you can't go back and you're not, like, picking out DNA from a mummy or something to test the changes.
This is the cool part of this, because it's not part of our study, but in a few cases, we actually do have DNA from ancient skeletons, and we can see that these things weren't there. This is why lactase is the best example of this, because a group of Germans studied some ancient German skeletons, 5,000-year-old skeletons. This is the beginnings of agriculture in Europe. And when they sampled these skeletons for these genes, they found that the lactase gene was not there. The active form in adults was not there in this ancient sample. Now, that's exactly what we expect. We know that this gene originated recently based on its variation in living people. But when we go back and study the skeletons, and we can show that, and in fact, it wasn't there. These people were starting to drink milk. They were starting to have this new diet that depended on that resource. They were subject to the advantage that gene would have given them, but they didn't have it yet because it was new. It had just started to spread. So that's a really concrete case where we can say, yes, this has absolutely changed over time. Now, for most genes, we don't have that kind of historical detail yet, but it's going to become really important to be able to study these ancient remains to find the evidence that these genes have changed in time in different places, you know, more broadly beyond the few samples that we've so far been able to look at today.
Well, out of curiosity, you picked out the one gene that seemed to hit pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that, you know, the variation occurs on the gene sequences.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any changes or differences in the gene sequences between the two, between today and then the ancient,
absolutely.
Ancient
there's,
people?
There's, yeah, there's,
so you can determine that specifically.
We can tell very specifically where we have samples. That's, you know, in that sense, we're sample limited.
Okay. Well, let me, okay, you mentioned this a little bit, but let me, you know, touch on it again. You know, how many and, you know, how do you know that it's come from natural selection?
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that it's natural selection as opposed to other kinds of forces, like random chance, because of the pattern. We can see that it's too common and too recent to have been something other than natural selection. But I think that what you might be getting at is, you know, how do you know it's natural selection and not something we've done to each other, you know, or the pressures that we put on each other for mating, that sort of thing. That's more difficult to answer. Let me give you an example. One gene that appears to have been under recent selection is the gene that makes Europeans, some of them, have blue eyes. Now, I don't know why people have blue eyes. I don't know what it does for you. There are all kinds of myths and rumors about what it does for you. For instance, blue-eyed people are supposed to be able to see better at night, or they're supposed to be better marksmen, you know, they're better at shooting arrows, or they're supposed to be, you know, friendlier. Maybe it's a sign of youth, you know, because kids sometimes have blue eyes and then they lose them, so it means that you're young. There's all kinds of stories for the advantage of blue eyes. I think that this gene, which looks like it's under selection, so we know that blue eyes probably are very recent in Europeans, this gene probably isn't under selection for making your eyes blue, because you have to have two copies of it to get blue eyes. It's really hard to select for something recessive like that. It's probably some other effect of this gene, but it's not an effect that we know about. You know, we just don't know what other kinds of things go along with this that might have been subject to selection. So this is the problem with really trying to unravel exactly what all of them do. We can see the evidence for change, but not in every case, and in fact, in only a few cases, can we say with great specificity what the change did. What is it for? Why was this good for people?
Can you, you know, be specific as to when blue eyes first
This
came
gene
about?
Is one of the longest examples, and when I say long, what I mean in genetic terms is recent. So it's very common in Europeans, and it's very recent. We suspect that it's within the last 8,000 years. But that means, you know, to put just a very sharp point on it, it means that 10,000 years ago, there were no blue-eyed people in the world. You know, that's a real recent change.
So, you know, technically then that would be a mutation that occurred.
It's a mutation, makes and people
somehow,
have blue eyes.
Somehow, which you can't define right now, that it got into the gene pool and kept progressing.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of genes that affect pigmentation. I mean, this is one of the classic old examples of variation in humans. Some people are dark-skinned, some people are light-skinned. A lot of the genes that influence pigmentation, make you lighter, are very recent. They're things that have changed recently in the context of Europeans and West Asians, and also in the context of East Asians. It looks like there's about a dozen genes in each of those populations. For the most part, they're not the same genes. You know, both of these populations have been under selection to lighten their skin tone for probably the classic reasons that this is advantageous to have more vitamin D absorption, which comes from ultraviolet light, for instance. But it's a sign of how recent they are that it's actually different things happening in different places. Populations are responding to this selection pressure faster than they can spread their genes back and forth to other places.
Interesting. So one question I was wondering you brought up, then a lot of traits are have multiple genes that affect those traits. Then.
A lot of them are.
And it could be different genes for different kinds of people.
That's right. Take malaria as an example. Falciparum malaria is the biggest disease killer in the world today and historically. It's a huge burden on populations in the tropics that have this falciparum parasite. There are over 20 genes in West Africans that are known to be resistance factors for malaria. And when I say resistance factors, they're obviously not perfect. If they were, there'd be no malaria. But they're factors that tend to make you survive a little better. Each of those affects a different gene. Some of them are multiple mutations to the same gene. So we have the human hemoglobin molecule carries blood, has lots of different variations that try to resist malaria in tropical populations. There's different ones in different places. But there are other genes also. G6PD deficiency, which makes you have, it's called favism because it makes you allergic to fava beans. Almost 95% in sub-Saharan Africa, it's there because it helps resist malaria. So those kinds of changes, multiple genes involved in the same pattern of selection. They're there for the same reason.
Well, let me ask you a follow-up question. I'm glad you brought up malaria, at least disease-wise. I'm kind of curious. I've been kind of curious since reading some of your stuff about the nature versus nurture thing going on here. particularly when it comes to disease, of course. I agree that, you know, sometimes in our past that, you know, when we come, immunity to a disease will build up, and then that becomes part of our gene pool, and then that gets passed on.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm wondering about is, you know, science in particular and medical advances, what you call, you know, what we do to ourselves, seems to me more of an effect.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, that kind of diminishes our immunity because we have the ability to, you know, treat disease as it happens, so to speak. And in a sense, that in an effect has, you know, increased our lifespan and kind of increased our population growth too.
Well, it changes things. Populations change under natural selection because people are variable in when they die. and they're variable in when and how many kids they have. You know, those are the basic factors. Do you live long enough to have kids, and how many do you have? Today, what we've done with medicine is really reduce the variation in when you die. You know, you think, well, you know, there's still a lot of variation in when we die, but it's reduced to the extent that in the past, and in some populations still, there's huge infant mortality. And every one of those kids that dies before they're five doesn't make it to age 20 to have kids. So that variability is what medicine has reduced. It's reduced the opportunity for change due to selection on mortality. But what it hasn't reduced is variation in fertility. We still have huge variation in how many kids we have.
Yeah, that's true.
And anything that relates to that in terms of maintaining fertility longer in your life, in terms of making you more likely to have kids younger, those are things that are potential targets of selection.
Okay, I want to get back to this, but let's have a musical break there, Bill. Okay, we're back. Sorry about that Mark couldn't make it in, so we're going to continue with our interview and prolong science news for another show, till another show. I was going to had a follow-up on what we had, but let me just get to the main point about the speed. How can you really, again, tell that our evolution is speeding up? I still don't quite understand how you know that.
Well, we can look at the way that we're talking about speed, you know, is a couple of different ways. One way is to look at skeletons. Now, if we compare ourselves today with people who lived 1,000 years ago in places where we have good skeletal samples, like Northern Europe, South Africa is a place with good skeletal samples, China is a place with really good skeletal samples. Compare people over that time span, you'll see that the rate of change in our skeleton is really fast. And the things that are changing, our teeth are getting smaller. People are losing their wisdom teeth. They're losing the third molars. And this isn't because the dentists come and pull them. It's because they didn't develop them in the first place. Their brains are shrinking. Brains have been shrinking across this time span. If we look across the last 10,000 years, you see other kinds of changes. We've reduced in our robusticity. Things that, you know, used to be strong muscle attachments and ridges on our skulls have reduced. The teeth reduced across that time period. If we compare that time period with the 100,000 years before that, the change in the last 10,000 years is bigger. So the speed in that sense has accelerated. It's been going faster. What our paper is most concerned with is the genes that support this change. We were able to show that if we've got 3,000 things that are changing recently, this fast, and if we extrapolated that out across the span of evolution between us and chimpanzees, say, well, we're talking about the last 10 to 20,000 years. For chimps, we're talking about 12 million years separating us, you know, 6 million back to our common ancestor, and then 6 million on down to chimps. The amount of change in the last 10,000 years extrapolated across that time span is vastly more. It's hundreds of times more than the number of genetic differences that we can observe between humans and chimps. And that means that these changes that we're seeing recently couldn't have been happening across that time span. They must, in fact, be going hundreds of times faster than they used to go.
So you can compare Homo sapiens with chimpanzees?
That's right. That's right. We've got the chimp genome. We've got the gorilla genome and the orangutan genome. In fact, we've got a really good comparison of what our genes are like compared to theirs. We can see some of the things that changed between us and them more than others. But what we have an especially good ability to see is the things that have changed very recently in humans, because we've sampled lots of humans. Someday we'll sample lots of chimps, and we'll see the things that happen in them, too.
Finally, we don't have that much time left, but let me ask you one other thing. Do you see trends, you know, from what you found so far, trends set from today to the future? Like, for instance, I'm like thinking things like obesity mm-hmm. is an epidemic today. Mm-hmm. Could that be genetically, could end up with a genetic marker?
Well,
or intelligence. There was a book I just recently read that our IQs are going up. I kind of question that, but sometimes. But things like that, for instance.
Well, let's look at obesity, because this is the big change, right? And we know it has a huge effect on health. But the thing is that obesity is not killing people, by and large, before they're done having kids. You know, there's some people who are affected okay. in their 30s, but it's, you know, it really doesn't come on until later. Yet, obesity is impacting fertility. If you're obese, you have lower fertility. And so that means that there is the potential for genetic change in response to this. But that speed of genetic change is actually pretty slow compared to the kinds of cultural changes that are causing obesity. So I expect that changes that we see in the future will be changes that we do deliberately to ourselves, like genetic engineering.
Okay. Okay. Thanks a lot, John.
Sure.
You have just listened to a show that originally aired on January 17th, 2008. Please ignore the PNM email address mentioned in this show. If you have any questions or would like to join PNM, please email scienceonwart@gmail.com. Please consider volunteering for PNM if interested. It's challenging, but very rewarding. Where else could you talk with John Hawks? And thanks to Charlie Pittman for engineering tonight, as usual. Thank you.